We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Dale Meyer, who serves as the Speaker of the Lutheran Hour, succeeding Dr. Oswald Hoffman on January the 1st, 1989. The messages of the Lutheran Hour are broadcast over 1,300 radio stations internationally. He was born in Chicago Heights, Illinois in 1947, and he is a 1973 graduate of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, receiving his Master of Divinity degree, and is the recipient of the MA and PhD degrees from Washington University here in St. Louis. From 1984 to 88, Meyer served as senior pastor of Holy Cross Lutheran Church, Collinsville, Illinois, and then he came as an assistant professor at Concordia Seminary from 1981 to 84, teaching classes in New Testament and homiletics. He also served as the director of resident field education during that time. From 1974 to 1981, he served as pastor of St. Salvatore and St. Peter Lutheran Churches in Venedy and New Memphis, Illinois. This is also where most of his illustrations come from, having sat in his classes. He served his vicarage at Calvary Lutheran Church in Lincoln Park, Michigan. He currently serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as a member of the Standing Committee on Pastoral Ministry, and also serves as the Concordia Scholarship today on that Advisory Committee for Concordia Publishing House. He has been the first vice president, second vice president, secretary, and circuit counselor in the Southern Illinois District of the LCMS, and pastoral advisor for the Southern Illinois District of the International Lutheran Layman's League. He has written, co-authored The Crosses of Lent, a sermon booklet, and Lifelight, in-depth Bible studies of Matthew, and has, of course, contributed to the Concordia Journal. Dr. Meyer is married to Diane, and they are the parents of Elizabeth and Catherine, and they reside in Collinsville, Illinois. We are certainly happy to have with us today Dr. Dale Meyer.
Thank you, Dean. You can do the eulogy at my funeral, but I'm glad that they gave you a copy of Dr. Grothy's book. It means you'll get something out of the next hour. And it's nice to be back to some place that I've been before. I always enjoy going back to some place where I have been. Maybe that's because when I was a kid, my brother and I used to sit in the back seat and we'd always look out the rear view mirror instead of looking forward to what was coming. That's carried through my life. With due respect to one of the most popular professors at that institution, Professor Rosso, we students always used to say that the best view of Concordia Senior College is in the rear view mirror on graduation day. And so it's nice to be back here. Well, you think about it. One of the places that I have fond remembrance of is parish ministry. When I was selected to be the Lutheran Hour speaker in October of 1988, the family was struggling to understand what does this mean. And my 9-year-old daughter, Katie, was especially struggling with it. And she said, "Dad, will you be our pastor?" And I said, "No, not really." And there followed silence. And the silence was only interrupted by two breaking hearts, Katie's and mine. I say that to indicate how important parish pastors are to the Meyer family. I don't think I could ever say how important they are to us. One of the privileges that I count in my life now is the fact that the new pastors at Holy Cross in Collinsville permit me graciously to do shut-in communions. So every month I'll go out and do about 10 shut-in communions. I did a few the other day. And I can't think of anything more in the course of a month that really, you know, turns me on and thrills me to be going out and doing those communions. Being a Lutheran Hour speaker or a seminary professor may be important jobs, but we're not really parish pastors, even if we do help out on the side. So I want to begin by saying to any of you who are parish pastors and to all of you who will be, that there's a lot of common families out there like the Meyer family that really have a high, high regard for who you are and what you will be doing. You are people of Easter, and what you do is lead us, the people of the church, to exult in a crucified and risen Christ. Now, most people have not yet come to Easter, and I am afraid that that also includes many of the people who regularly listen to you and to me. They are stuck at Good Friday, and Good Friday, all by itself, does not give much reason to exult. For Good Friday seemed to mark the triumph of evil. And for many people, evil, not exaltation, is reality. And so that makes you and the message that you preach or will be preaching all the more remarkable. Let us first of all consider the background of evil against which we preach. A conference was held last autumn under the auspices of the United Nations. The conference is on the plight of children in the world today. 40,000 children under the age of 5 are dying every day for reasons that are preventable. Think about that. 40,000 children under the age of 5 are dying every day for reasons that are preventable. You know, that is evil. And what does the church, what do you and I say to explain it? You know, I really don't think you can go into a camp where thousands of children are dying for whatever reason and hold up a placard that says John 3:16. It doesn't cut it. And I don't think you can go to the parents of 40,000 dying children and pull Romans 8:28 out of your hip pocket. Now, I believe Romans 8:28, and I believe John 3:16. But when we look at evil on this large a scale, preventable evil, I think we have to have an explanation that is a little bit more extensive and comprehensive than a simple laying a Bible passage on them. Item. Last July 30th, some soldiers went to St. Peter Lutheran Church in Monrovia, Liberia. And you know that they did not go to worship, but they went to slaughter. And they massacred some 600 refugees, mostly women and children. There was a time, even in pagan antiquity, where you could take refuge at an altar. But it doesn't seem to be that way anymore. That's evil. And we have to ask the question, what is God doing about it? Armenia and Azerbaijan are two feuding Soviet republics. The Azeris will not permit boxcars loaded with relief to pass through their territory into earthquake-ravaged Armenia. And the Armenians have the same lack of love for the Azeris. And what about the minority Russians and the majorities in the Baltic countries? What about the Serbs and Croatians who are at each other's throat in Yugoslavia? What about the deep-seated hatred between Germans and Poles? What of the bloodshed in South Africa? What of Northern Ireland? It is all evil. And a thoughtful person in the world and in the church has to ask, you know, God, why and what are you doing about it? Unless we think that evil is an un-American activity, listen to two newspaper articles. Great thing that with this job, And this job has got a lot of neat blessings, and one of them is traveling around and picking up the local newspaper. And I've become a newspaper addict, and I would recommend it to anybody. But I've got two articles here that I picked up. The first one was from Pensacola, Florida. It is interesting how the Holy Spirit has the habit of calling Lutheran Hour speakers to preach in Florida during the winter months. You know. I wanted to go to North Dakota, but as the passage says in Acts, I was prevented from going there. Well, here's a quote. The Reverend Bruce Wall takes four teenage boys to a pizza parlor in the violence-scored Dorchester section of Boston to hear what they have to say about their lives. Did they talk about basketball or girls, jobs, cars, or their future? No, they said. We know that we're either going to get shot or stabbed. And they discussed which they'd rather have happen to them, said Wall. Their choice in life was to be shot. Now, this is not in Azerbaijan or Northern Ireland. This is here. Those young people may very well realize their choice. Last August 24th, the Chicago Tribune ran an article from Reuters, and the Tribune entitled the article, "In Murder, There's No Comparison to the United States." The United States, it says, has pulled so far ahead in international murder statistics that it's in a class of its own, with some kill rates more than 70 times as high as other Western countries. In a new study comparing murders in 22 industrial countries, no nation even comes close to the U.S. Its overall murder rate is 2.6 to 8 times higher than elsewhere in the West. Americans between the ages of 15 and 24, and that ought to strike home to a lot of us. My two daughters are now 16 and 11, and you may have children in or near that age group, and some of you certainly have grandchildren in that age group. Americans between 15 and 24 are a fifth of the homicide victims. They are being murdered at rates 74 times higher than Austrians, 73 times higher than Japanese, and 22 times higher than West Germans in that age group. A recent Senate Judiciary Committee report projected a 1990 murder toll of 23,220. I did not see recently, but I understand, or I'm led to believe, that we certainly realized and probably exceeded that projection. And I'll tell you, it scares me. Some time ago, there were two young boys murdered in St. Louis County, and they went out looking for the murderers. The two boys were found in what had been thought to be a residential safe area. Turns out that a brother of one of the boys was arrested for the murder. You know, this gets close. And I like to think of myself as a bit of a man, but I don't have any hesitation to stand in front of you or anybody else and say, this really scares me. And the question is, God, why, and what are you doing about it? And what are we doing about it? Whether they are victims, perpetrators, or witnesses, our listeners' lives are surrounded with terrible and unrelenting evil. How does the church and our message address the presence of such great evil? And then the question comes, are we addressing it? In many cases, the answer is no. The electronic media that have brought us an information glut have also saturated us with so much evil news that we are numb to the enormity of the profound suffering and evil all about us. And I don't say that as a diatribe against TV, radio, or the media. It's just a fact. We have been numbed. And the result for many church people has been both a hibernation in parochialism and a failure to engage current issues theologically. One example. For some weeks before the outbreak of the war, I was informally polling people, and I stress informally. I ask, has your pastor preached about the Gulf crisis? And the answer always came back, no, but we've been saying prayers about it. I can imagine probably what the prayers were. Now that certainly changed. Yeah, I hope it changed after the 16th when we went to war. But the failure to speak sooner and to speak theologically to an impending crisis that was occupying our hearers' minds must have left our members like sheep without a shepherd. The Lutheran Hour was also culpable here. Because of a 3-month production lead time, Desert Shield was never addressed on our 1,200 or 1,300 English stations until it had become Desert Storm. Now, the Gulf War was addressed with a special broadcast this last Sunday, and I hope that that special effort will provide, among other things, a prototype for more timely messages and a quicker delivery. It's my own personal hope that we can get back to the time that the Lutheran, we can get to the time, I'm still looking out the rearview mirror, look forward to the time when the Lutheran Hour is a live or an almost live program. It used to be that way. Many people, especially in the western part of the United States, heard about Pearl Harbor from Dr. Meyer, the real Dr. Meyer.
I heard your father preach in Chicago.
Well, sir, I heard him preach too, but it wasn't in church, and I can't repeat what he said. Get that all the time. And in fact, I've got, and I'll mention this later on, they called it a Loki or a Truppus. I've got a standard thing. I said, before you ask, yes, I am related to Walter Meyer. He was my uncle. Uncle Wally died 6 years ago. He was a milkman who belonged to the Wisconsin Senate. The value of that is it comes in the response. If the congregation laughs, I know they understand the Lutheran Hour. If they don't, which once in a while they don't, I know that, you know, this congregation doesn't know the Lutheran Hour from the man in the moon. So anyway, the Lutheran Hour, because of the production schedules, procedures, is also been culpable here, but I hope that changes. It is not that the Lutheran Hour, or the parish pulpit, is to become a weekly political soapbox. Indeed not. But rather, we are to lead our people to see all things theologically through Christ. Unfortunately, the absence of theology applied to current situations has left many of our people to practice a Christianity that does not engage the real world. In demonstration whereof, I submit the following. On January 17th, the day after Desert Storm began, I went to my regular Thursday morning Bible class over in Collinsville. And what was the class discussing as I walked in on this morning after our nation went to war? The class was in a vigorous discussion about the propriety of the wedding march. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. But that was on their minds more so, apparently, than a war. I'd been up most of the night, not only following the war, but recording that special message. So we shut the discussion down pretty quick. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says in his Cost of Discipleship that Christ has cut us off from all immediacy with the things of this world. He wants to be the center. Through him alone all things shall come to pass. He stands between us and God. And for that very reason, he stands between us and all other men and things. We cannot establish direct contact outside ourselves except through him, through his word, and through our following of him. To think otherwise is to deceive ourselves. We have to preach about evil, not just a stereotyped evil that we are accustomed to do, you know, the big sins, adultery, murder. I'm afraid that abortion for a lot of people has become a stereotype sin. They expect to hear us rail against that. But we have to engage theologically whatever our people are seeing and hearing in the anti-pulpit, which is television and radio. Now, moving on, there are people who have the weighty things of this world on their minds. Unfortunately, many of them are responding to the question of evil with answers that are unacceptable to us. They indict both Christianity and the God of our faith. Christianity is dismissed by many as archaic and irrelevant. It's not only that the old paradigms of Christianity no longer dominate our society. To many people, the old paradigms of Christianity just don't work. I recall some years ago, in fact, that's while I was still working here, I taught a summer class at one of our colleges, and I enjoyed that. But I met a brother pastor, whom I'd lost track of for many years, who was there, and he was on a CRM status because he had burned out from the ministry, in the ministry. I don't know what it was that burned out, and I didn't think it appropriate for me to ask too many questions. But one thing that he said, I'll never forget it, he said, the old cliches don't work anymore. Now, this is a pastor saying that. The old cliches don't work anymore. And I think a lot of people outside of the church and maybe are inside the church are thinking, if not saying it. One New Ager put it this way, the old story doesn't work anymore, quote, unquote. For some serious-minded people, Christianity itself is the source of much blatant evil in our society and world. Forrest Wood has recently written The Arrogance of Faith, a study of Christianity and race relations in the United States. Now, I'm tempted to say you ought to read that, but you got lots of things that you're reading anyway, so you don't need another guilt trip put on you about reading a book. But The Arrogance of Faith by Forrest Wood is to me a dynamite indictment of Christianity. And I don't think he's got the story all right, but let me read you some of the quotes from Forrest Wood. And this is a study, I don't know if I said this, a study in Christianity and race relations in the United States. Wood says, quote, there has been no greater religious force in the dehumanization of humans than Christianity, the self-proclaimed religion of peace, brotherly love, and fellowship. Again, he quotes Bertrand Russell, the whole contention that Christianity has had an elevated moral influence can only be maintained by wholesale ignoring or falsification of the historical evidence. And again, and you may like this one, true freedom came from the emancipation of the will from the power of sin. Southern Presbyterian James Henley Thornwell argued. Context here is talking about how preachers defended slavery. True freedom comes from the emancipation of the will from the power of sin, Southern Presbyterian James Henley Thornwell argued. Nor was it a lesson used only by Southern clergy. Both George Junkin, a prominent Ohio Presbyterian, and C.F.W. Walther, head of the conservative Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church, argued publicly that biblical freedom meant only freedom from damnation, and that it, quote, could be preserved within the framework of a servant-master relationship, end of quote. Back to Wood, since it was the Christian master who kept the bondsman in chains and the Christian minister who defended that bondage, it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that the problem was Christianity. And maybe I should say, I think, I may be wrong on this, but I think Brother Mollering Wood got his information there in that quote from your brother, who wrote in the 50s or so an article. I may be wrong on that, but your brother is quoted in the bibliography of Wood. Well, keep going, Dale. Uh, I got no longer, you know, since I don't have to live with my listeners anymore, people. You know, I've gotten awfully long. While Wood's criticism forces us to a sober self-examination, it is also an attack upon God and upon his and our revealed religion. Atheists have leveled the attack most directly. Now, here I don't mean the unthinking atheist, but rather the serious-minded person who has wrestled with the problem of God and evil, although their resultant atheism still leaves them under Psalm 14, verse 1. H.J. McCloskey wrote an essay entitled God and Evil, and I want to do two things. First of all, McCloskey quotes Brothers Karamazov, and I want to read this quotation to you. Perhaps I'm overkilling on this idea of evil in the world, but you and I have also been saturated, and I want to drive that point home as best I can. McCloskey makes this quotation from Dostoevsky. By the way, a Bulgarian I met lately in Moscow, Ivan went on, told me about the crimes committed by the Turks in all parts of Bulgaria through fear of a general rising of the Slavs. They burn villages, murder, outrage women and children, and nail their prisoners by the ears to the fences, leaving them till morning, and in the morning hang them. All sorts of things you can't imagine. People talk sometimes about bestial cruelty, but that's a great injustice and an insult to the beasts. A beast can never be so cruel as a man, so artistically cruel. The tiger only tears and gnaws, and that's all he can do. He would never think of nailing people by the ears, even if he were able to do it. These Turks took a pleasure in torturing children, too, cutting the unborn child from the mother's womb and tossing babies up in the air and catching them on the points of their bayonets before the mother's eyes. Doing it before the mother's eyes was what gave zest to the amusement. Here's another scene that I thought was interesting. Imagine a trembling mother with her baby in her arms, a circle of invading Turks around her. They've planned a diversion. They pet the baby to make it laugh. They succeed. The baby laughs. At that moment, a Turk points a pistol 4 inches from the baby's face. The baby laughs with glee, holds out its little hand to the pistol, and he pulls the trigger in the baby's face and blows out its brains. Artistic, wasn't it? Dostoevsky. And McCloskey writes, evil is a problem for the theist in that a contradiction is involved in the fact of evil on the one hand and the belief in the omnipotence and perfection of God on the other. God cannot be both all-powerful and perfectly good if evil is real. And then he goes on, he presents some solutions to the problem of evil, solutions that Christians have presented. And I think, and you probably would agree, that as he shoots them down validly. The conclusion of the matter is that God does not exist. So it appears remarkable to me that you and I should be exultant people who set out to use our words to woo a world to Christ. Remarkable is a charitable word. Kindly critics dismiss you and me as dinosaurs of past belief systems that are archaic and irrelevant. They may humor and patronize us for the little social niceties that we perform, but many of them do not take us seriously. Harsher critics will call us irresponsible, even traitors to our humanity, for urging a belief in a God who permits such terrible evil to go seemingly unchecked. Evil is what Good Friday is about. And Good Friday is where so many of our hearers and humanity have taken their permanent residence. When you and I engage our hearers with the evil that is all about them, it should obviously be a theological engagement. And when we talk about evil, we must always add the name of one more innocent victim, and that is Jesus Christ. McCloskey and the atheists, secular humanists, New Agers, and Christians see a contradiction between a good God and evil. And many, including Christians, some Christians at least, are striving to move on to Easter without coming to terms with Good Friday. You can't get to Easter until you've groveled in the evil of Good Friday. And Good Friday is terrible without knowing Easter. Too many people have not noticed, and it may well be because we have not told them clearly enough, that God himself has been victimized by evil. Their arguments tend to center on God's omnipotence. Why doesn't God eliminate evil? For example, Wood, the man who mentioned C.F.W. Walther and so on, tells about an exchange between a missionary and an Indian tribe, I think Susquehanna Indians. And he and the missionary presented the Christ of the cross. And Wood says, quote, "The Indian was dumbfounded by a faith whose omnipotent being allowed his own son to be killed. What kind of omnipotence was that? It just did not make sense." You and I can exult, and we can urge our people to exult, because God dealt with evil by becoming its greatest victim. Rather than invoking powerful legions of angels in Gethsemane, God's Son went to the cross. Rather than hopping down from that cross because of the pain Christ suffered, rather than establish his kingdom by force, Christ endured the rejection of those kingdoms that are based on power. Hebrews 2 says, and we could quote 1,000 passages, "He also took on flesh and blood, so that by his death he might take away all the power of death, and thus he might free those who were subjected to slavery all their lives by their fear of death." I love that passage because we have a society that is afraid of dying, afraid of what's ahead. And where is God, we might wonder? Well, you and I find him at the cross. You find him where people suffer because of evil. You find him dead and buried, a true, and to passers-by, certainly also a hopeless son of man. Preaching evil and proclaiming evil's greatest, albeit temporary, victim, has few greater allies. I'm jumping a little bit ahead of myself. We find him at the cross. We find him at the cross. And let me get myself in order again. If I don't say it later, I say it now. That McCloskey and Wood and a lot of these people know Christianity very well. But in my reading, they are dealing with caricatures of biblical Christianity, and especially the theology of the cross. That they don't know. And I think they can be refuted. But the battle has to be joined not at the omnipotence of God, but at the cross in the second article. And I am sure that no refutation based on the theology of the cross is going to blow these guys away. You know, they're going to keep sending the scuds of Christianity. But that's the place where the battle needs to be joined. I want to say that so that I don't leave the impression, hey, that these guys are right and our enterprise is invalid. And one of the things we need to do is to refute them, because their thinking has sent worse than chemical warfare into our society. We preaching evil and proclaiming evil's greatest, although temporary, victim, has few greater allies, I believe, than the calendar of the church. Bloodshed is almost as old as this world. Evil, blood, and death have always been present in the worship of God. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was a day of bloodshed that prefigured the sacrifice of Christ. It has been called the Good Friday of the Old Testament. The Day of Atonement began with a sacrifice of a bull for the sins of the high priest and his family. high priests had sins that needed atonement. And so also pastors, professors, speakers, students have sins that need atonement today. And I would say to some of the students, maybe to all of us, that my experience in my relatively short life is that the sins that I thought were so bad in Dale Meyer as a seminary student turned out to be not as bad as the other sins of which I was unaware. And there are a lot of things, fortunately, in life, good things like church and serving the pastoral ministry, that point out the really bad sins which we may not know about. Okay? And that'll happen in the years ahead, and thank God when you go home and want to cry, because he is really working a blessing through the cross. Anyway, the high priest sacrificed a bull for his sins and the sins of his family. But now compare Christ, the sinless Son of God. And properly understood, we do speak about the innocent victims of crime. But Christ truly was an innocent victim of crime, a perfect lamb led to slaughter. And Christ willingly let his blood be shed. That stands in marked distinction to the way it works in this world. The high priest on the Day of the Atonement shed someone else's blood. The animal was forced to give up its life. Most of you have seen the movie Patton. And the movie Patton begins with the outspoken general addressing the troops who are going off to the European and African theaters. And he says words to the effect that you are not going to die for your country, you're going to make the other guy die for his. Patton didn't say it in those words. And since I'm on a seminary campus, I won't say what Patton said, and it'd be the first time you heard those words anyway. I guess it would be. There's a different kind of a humor present on a seminary than anywhere else in the world. I always noticed that. I love to sit in the back of the chapel. And when the students laughed, I didn't know it was funny. And when I laughed and the other profs laughed, the students didn't laugh. So you have to forgive me. My kids say, Dad, that's really dumb. Anyway, in this world, you make the other guy shed his blood. But Christ did it differently. When he went to the Good Friday cross of Calvary, he willingly let his blood be shed. Now, at this stage, some form of omnipotence, the omnipotence question might be raised. You know, why did Christ deal with evil by becoming its greatest victim? Why didn't he invoke legions of angels? Why didn't he bring in the Fifth Army? And a thing that Americans would do is, why didn't he write out a check to pay the price? It's easier to get money out of people in your congregations these days than time out of them. We want to buy our way out. Why didn't God solve the problem of evil this way? The answer is really simple. The wages of sin is death. The consequences of humanity's evil is death, spiritual, physical, and eternal. And this has to be explained in detail to our hearers, and maybe more so now that we're living and ministering in a biblically illiterate society than ever before. Preaching evil, which we must do, involves, I think, more specifically, the preaching about the nature of sin and the attributes of God. On the attributes of God, there are limits to the extent that we and our listeners can properly anthropomorphize God in our speech and thought. We human beings are complex creatures who can be righteously angry one moment and forgiving the next. No human being is totally and always dominated by one attribute. I remember the great revelation was to me that my dad would get angry, and I could see, because I had sinned, I would see the veins in his arm popping out and in his neck, and he was mad, and I was ready to go to hell. But I learned to lay low for a while, and eventually he would set his anger by. And his just anger and righteousness at what I had done wrong was set aside, and something new dominated him, a love and a forgiveness. Now, that's the way we are. God is different. God is not complex. He is a pure and simple being. He is totally and always just, totally and always forgiving, totally and always faithful, etc., etc. He is not controlled by one attribute now and another tomorrow. Pieper has two quotations, one from Beyer. Though in reality these perfections or attributes are not accidents, nor in reality different from the divine essence, they are nevertheless distinguished from the divine essence and likewise from one another, because our finite and imperfect reason cannot comprehend the infinite perfection of God. Gerhardt, although within God himself the divine attributes are in reality not distinct from the other, nor from the divine essence, nevertheless the weakness of our mind requires that we deal with them one by one. Our hearers, and we understand why, conceptualize God in human terms. But that goes too far when they imagine that God lets his justice go unsatisfied because his love has taken over. When hearers make that mistake and understand God's attributes as if they were the attributes of human beings, then the significance of Christ's sacrifice on Calvary has been undercut. And even more problems can follow. If God is love, as we are always told, and if divine justice has gone unsatisfied because it yielded to love, as our hearers erroneously think, then sin is really not all that terrible. And perhaps the gross sins, murder, etc., are, but certainly not the smaller, victimless sins. And if sin is not so terrible and damning, at least the sins that we Christians do, maybe we and God can overcome it together, and presto, we are in the camp of the new evangelicals. And so I think that in preaching evil, we have to preach the attributes of God and remind our people that he is not a human being. He is far above us. My wife has a number of regular correspondents on the telephone. And this is not true of my wife, but it is true of one of them, very, very religious in the new evangelical sense, about whom we will get to later in this Lutheran vanishing hour. And Diane tells me, you know, the latest thing that her good friend has said, and it's amazing. You know, I wish I knew how God works the way she does. Got it all figured out. You know, it's the phone call each day is our daily briefing from God. It's turned him into one of us. Got him in a hip pocket. Same way Saddam Hussein does. And in preaching evil, I think we got to impress that, man, he's nothing like us. You know, Psalm 8, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. Well, the righteous God must punish sin. And while he may delay punishment, the punishment for sin must be exacted, and most logically that must be exacted from you and me, the sinner. But how can a human being, weak and fallible as we are, satisfy the righteous anger of our Creator? Eternity would not be long enough for us to placate his wrath. Death is the only payment for sin. But my death through all eternity is not sufficient to placate his wrath against what I have done against him. And you can't substitute for me. It's not just a substitutionary death is going to do it, because you can't save your own self with death, you know, in death. How are you going to save me or me you? It is only an incarnate Son of God who could do that. Only one who brings the divine attributes into this world of evil and suffers on our behalf. He is the only rescue, and he did that on Good Friday. And there Christ was sacrificed once and for all. Whereas the sacrifice on the Day of the Atonement had to be repeated every 10th day of every 7th month of every year, over and over and over again, the incarnate Son of God was sacrificed for sin once and for all. Hebrews 7, here is the high priest we needed, holy, innocent, spotless, separated from sinners and made higher than the heaven. He does not need to bring sacrifices every day like those high priests, first for his own sake, then for the sins of the people. For he did this once and for all when he sacrificed himself. God met evil on its own turf. And although it first appeared that evil had won again, The result, witness the Emmaus disciples. The victory was apparent, not real. By raising his son, God accepted the sacrifice for sin, and Christ, it is finished, was assured forever. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ. Now we have reason to exult. Good Friday can now be understood in view of Easter. And I'm not going to go on too much about Easter, but Easter validated the sacrifice on the cross. You and I and our listeners are people who live in Good Friday every day. Evils, whether they're the parochial evils of the wedding march or the worldwide evils that are far more weighty and should engage our attention, evil is around all of us. And they make this, and maybe here's my piety, they make this a veil of tears. I mean, I love the world, great things in this world, and I love to be a flower child, but I'm convinced this is a veil of tears. And if this was the only thing I had, is this veil of tears, I'd want to stay here as long as possible. But we've got Easter and we've got heaven, so we contend with our daily Good Fridays with hope. Colossians 1, Christ in you, Christ in us, the hope of glory. And that crucified and risen Christ needs to be preached into us. The hope, the Christ, needs to be preached into people. And that's why God put us here. That proclamation is sorely needed. We live in an evangelical world, writes Harold Sinkbeil in his book Sanctification. I think that's a required book in some of your courses. I think it's a tremendous book. We live in an evangelical world. The complex of evangelical views dominates the Christian media, TV, radio, and print. We have let them, quote, eat our lunch. And I think synod, more appropriately the Lutheran hour, are culpable there too. These guys are eating our lunch. They control the media, TV, radio, and most of the publishing. So they're dominating. Their doctrines, but even more so their pieties, are evident in the sincere statements of many of our Lutheran laity. If I had a dollar for every time I heard evangelical piety from lay people, you know, I wouldn't be working anymore. I would be a rich man. Christ's death and the forgiveness of sins is seen as the introductory doctrine to the church. It's kind of like introduction to pastoral ministry. Do you still have that class? You have to take it and then get on to the real stuff, you know? They see, that's not true. That's not, I get myself in trouble. But anyway, they see the forgiveness of sins as an introductory doctrine to the church. Once introduced, the Christian moves on to more mature spiritual doctrines. That the justification of the sinner is the article by which the church stands or falls would not score very highly on a Gallup poll in this evangelical world. Sinkbeil makes a telling observation in his thorough and charitable study of the writings of Charles Swindoll. And I underline charitable because he deals with Swindoll as a fellow Christian. He is very charitable, and we must be too. You catch more flies with sugar than vinegar. Sinkbeil says, quote, if sin is pictured mostly as moral blight, which is the tendency with the new evangelicals, it is not surprising that the gospel gets somewhat of a short shrift. In this view of sanctification, the Christian is left to his own devices. His own sanctified will, not the power of the Holy Spirit, is the motivational power for correct choices in his life. In the three books under study, and what he's done is systematically studied Sinkbeil, and I don't remember what the three books are. But in those three books, totaling some 690 pages, there are only six references to the redemption purchased by Christ on the cross. I mean, you got to memorize that. Six references to the redemption of the cross in 690 pages. Only one of the six could be called an explicit reference, and it is hedged with a condition, And here's a quote from Swindoll. When the penalty of our sin was paid in full by Jesus Christ on the cross, God's wrath was expressed against him, the one who took our place. God was therefore satisfied in the epochal sacrifice, allowing all who would turn in faith to the Son of God to be totally, once for all, forgiven. Now, this, I think, is a telling quotation, at least it is to me. In some ways, the evangelical approach that dominates the media and the piety of many of our own people parallels the earlier mentioned critics of God. Secular humanism, New Age, and atheism put the focus for good on humanity. Now, evangelical Christians are Christians, but they often place their greatest emphasis upon the Christian sanctified action. Certainly, Christ has broken the dominion of sin, and through the means of grace, God enables the Christian to amend a sinful life. And we need to stress that, I think, more and more. I remember when I was confirmed in 1961, and our sainted pastor in Chicago, he didn't give us any of these questions ahead of time. He didn't say, you know, you can get questions 1, 5, and 6, or he didn't even give us 30 questions and say, know the answers, you know. And I never did it that way in my ministry either, because I wanted to do it to others the way it had been done unto me. But yeah, little Dale always wanted to be a pastor, okay? So Reverend Brower knew that he had an anchor man, a cleanup hitter, because I took this religious stuff pretty seriously. And whenever he was in trouble, he would call on Dale. So now it's 45 minutes of examination, and he needs to finish up. So he says, Dale, and I stood up in the church filled with people, and he says, if you're going to communion, what are the three questions that you should ask yourself? I said, first of all, am I a sinner? Reverend Brower said, yes, that's true. What's the second question? Do I believe that Jesus is my Savior? Yes, Dale, that is true. What is the third question? Oh, man, I can't think of it. I can't think of it. You know, start to really get upset. And he started to give me clues, hints. He was leading me on because, you know, we still had to get on to the rest of the service. Finally, bless his heart, George Albrecht, who was sitting in the row behind me, whispered the answer. We cheated on our confirmation. George says, amend. Oh, will I amend my sinful life? See, that's the third answer. Now, yeah, I forgot that. See, and we forget that. Bonhoeffer has a quotation. He says that we make God out. God justifies the sinner. God does not justify the sin. See, and so we need to help our people take these means of grace to break, as the hymn says, to break the power of canceled sin. Okay. But we don't take it to the extreme of the new evangelicals and make that what the cross was solely about. First, the forgiveness of sin for me who so desperately needs it, and then through the means to break the power of canceled sin. The evangelical success with how-to Christianity should be an incentive to us to present the Lutheran proclamation of sanctification. And then I gave you the Bonhoeffer quote. Lutheran proclamation, in conclusion, is to prevent these truths of Good Friday and Easter from becoming just an introduction or an otherworldly Platonic ideal that is unrelated to the present evil world in which we live. And preachers are to burn the reality of the crucified and resurrected one into the attitudes of people baptized into the death and resurrection of Christ. The contemporary evil brought to us by the media must be interpreted by the cross, and that the individual here is in a fearful struggle in is preaching's greatest task. We are not in Judge Wapner's courtroom, TV spectators watching someone else on trial for their evil. The sermon is to take the listener into that fearful battle where a Savior contends successfully for our eternal destiny. And you know, we don't have enough fear of God, righteous, correctly understood, Lutheran understood fear of God. We're going to stand before him one day. Preaching is supposed to take people into that fearful battle where the Savior contends successfully on our behalf. Preaching is to prevent the biblical message of evil and forgiveness from becoming an introduction or an otherworldly platonic activity unrelated to this world in which we live. Preaching is to prevent Good Friday and Easter from becoming mere speed bumps as we race through the liturgical year, if indeed we even bother to observe the liturgical year anymore. This ain't a speed bump. This is it. This is where we stop and park the car, and we don't want to move on any farther, because when you move away from the cross of the resurrected Christ, you're getting away from where the truth really is. Are we emphatic enough when we tell our hearers that Christ's sacrifices earn complete forgiveness for their sin? We have to remember in preaching that we are dealing with a spoken style, not a written style. And in a written style, you can say, Jesus died for your every sin, and the reader can pause and ponder that. But in a spoken style, which is different, you know, sometimes you can't just say it once. You gotta hammer it away so that they hear it. So when you preach, remember, spoken and written styles are two different creatures. One of the benefits of being a non-parish pastor, like a speaker or a professor, is that we get to repeat sermons from place to place. You know, I've preached once in Frankenmuth, Michigan, on Zechariah 3. So if you want to memorize that location, Zechariah 3 is a great passage. And the next week I was in Iowa, preached the same sermon, and the nice old lady came out and she said, well, Zechariah didn't change much this week, did he? And I was flabbergasted. She had been in Frankenmuth and then she was in Iowa. And I've just since discovered our snowbirds go from the north, they go down to Florida, and if you preached it up north, don't repeat it in Florida. But anyway, speakers and profs get to repeat. And in the course of that repeating, we may sometimes repeat a whole sermon, or certainly we repeat parts of a sermon. The Greeks used to call these tropoi. The Romans called them loci, commonplaces. There's standard paragraphs that you invoke and use that. And I have a standard paragraph that I think I'll probably use now till I go to my grave. It's after I've done made the obligatory reference to Christ and his death, I say, now we're going to stop here and pause for a little bit and not rush on. When Jesus died on the cross, he forgave your every sin. You know, maybe your wife or husband, parents or children are on your case because of something they say you did wrong. And my experience is, you know, yeah, I really did wrong, even though I don't want to admit it. Maybe your co-workers and friends are on your case because you did something wrong, or they say you did. And maybe your conscience accuses you. You know, what you did wrong can never, ever be made right in this world. That may all be true in this world. But when Christ died on the cross, he forgave your every sin, period. It is not necessary for you to do good works to complete your salvation. It is not necessary to go to church, to pray, you know, to complete the work of Christ in your salvation. And on and on. Those things, yes, they are necessary. Very, 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 very necessary. But they do not finish the salvation. When Christ died and said, it is finished, period, it was finished. And when God raised him on Easter, that validated the sacrifice. You know, that's the standard paragraph. And I'll tell you, they listen. You know, and I don't think it's just because it's a new preacher with different diction and a different delivery. They listen. I was in Wheaton a couple weeks ago, and somebody right over in that area, way in the back of the church, their view had been obscured through most of the sermon, but she leaned forward. She's looking. They listened to this. And I don't think it's just that there's a different preacher. I think it's that deep down they want to hear every sin has been forgiven. They want the Hauptartikel of the church, the forgiveness of our sins by Jesus. they cannot necessarily articulate it that way. You know, Adam and Eve said, hey, we were naked and we were ashamed. Adam and Eve didn't articulate the exact problem. It was sin more so than the nakedness. And the people in the world today, fearful of evil, they cannot always articulate that it's sin. But they do know deep down that they need to be forgiven, and they listen. You and I are sent out to tell them that Jesus died and has forgiven every sin. They have a desire to know Easter hope. And that Easter hope is something we need when we're being pulverized by our daily Good Fridays. Hearers want Christ in them, the hope of glory. And they look to you and me to preach Christ into them. Thank you.